questions and comments. We're talking not just about the Arab-Israeli conflict. We're aware of that, particularly as it's manifested itself between Israel and what are sometimes called the confrontation states, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. More particularly, we're not just going to talk about the current crisis in Lebanon, but rather the whole of the Middle East stretching from the Mediterranean across into Iran, from Turkey in the north, which is not fully part of the Middle East, but is partly there, down to the Gulf states in the south. This includes also then Egypt and much of North Africa. The term Middle East is a relatively modern term, comes really out of a British logistic planners in World War II. It's what used to be called the Near East, or even at one time it was even called simply the East. More common term in geography is increasingly becoming Southwest Asia, because it is the continent of Asia, and it is the southwestern corner. So we're talking about that part of the world. We're talking about the multiple conflicts, all the different wars which are going on, which includes the Iran-Iraq war, the current conflict in Lebanon, the continuing war between Israel and Syria, the continuing war, although it's inactive, between Israel and Jordan, the continuing disturbances on the Golan Heights with the Druze, the continuing disturbances on the West Bank, continuing disturbances in the Gaza Strip, the continuing problems between Kuwait and Iraq over a disputed territory, the continuing disputes between Saudi Arabia and certain of the Gulf states, the continuing problems between the two Yemens, the continuing problems in the Horn of Africa area, the continuing problem in the western part of North Africa, particularly the Polisario guerrillas and the Saharan conflict, and the continuing problem between Muammar Gaddafi of Libya and his neighbors, and the continuing problems in some of the other states of North Africa. If that got a little repetitive, it's just to remind you there are multiple conflicts going on there, all of which have some things in common, but all of which are separate ones. We often pick out the one particular conflict, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and think that that's the only one going on. We need to remember the other, including the Iran-Iraq, which is, you know, a major war that has been going on for over a year now, with each side just bloodying one another. So, first of all, some historical background as to where it began. One of the problems in any Middle East study is picking a year where to begin. You often pick a year not so much because it's right, but because it happens to be politically agreeable to as a starting point. So some date the problems to 1948, some to 1936 to 39, and the last attempts by the British to, before World War II, to establish this, an agreement. Or to 1929 and the Hebron riots, to 1917, to 1890, to 1798 when Napoleon invaded Egypt, back to 1451, back to 1099, back to, you can take it to the absurd and say it, you know, you can take it all the way back to when Ishmael and Isaac didn't really get along with in the household of Abraham. To pick a starting date is to reveal a political bias, because then you can, as if to say, before it there was no problem, when this happened, went from there. What we have as historical development is not a nice, neat, straight line that we like to think of with dates that we can scatter on. Middle Eastern history is much more like a spiral that sometimes goes inside of itself and sometimes encompasses everything. It's generally moving into the future, but it does so in a spiral pattern. That's the confusing aspect, because you can pick up something, you're farther ahead and yet you're farther behind. That's not a historically accurate one. But it's that aspect that things work, and when you begin talking about a particular problem in a particular area, you can immediately do that. For example, just to give you a set of dates. The town of Hebron, right now, has, in the southern part of the West Bank, has continuing problems between the Jewish settlements outside, which began in 1968. Well, let's start more recent. 1981, with the deposition and the exiling of the mayor of Hebron, okay, which dated back to 1968 and the beginning of a settlement outside of Hebron by a group who simply moved into a hotel and refused to leave. They were then moved to an army camp, and that was the beginning of the settlement. But you can trace it back to 1929, which was the time of what's sometimes called the Hebron Riots, which was a reaction in many parts of the West Bank, or in then mandatory Palestine, to the rapid immigration of Jews from Europe. But that dates back to 1917 and the end of World War I and the beginning of immigration, or the second immigration, when many Jews started coming in. But then that dates back to 1890 with the beginning of the modern Zionist movement, and it can keep going back. When do you start talking about the problems in Hebron? If you pick any one of the dates, you reveal a particular political viewpoint, because you can always say the problem did not really begin then. There are antecedents for it. But since we have to begin somewhere and you don't want to hear about everything that has happened since the time of Abraham, we're going to arbitrarily pick two dates, and that's the last two, 1890 and 1917. As dates that symbolized or brought to the public eye two distinct, independent, yet parallel movements. And I emphasize that because at the beginning they are distinct. We begin with Zionism and Arab nationalism. And in 1890, well, we'll give the dates for each one. 1890, Theodor Herzl, who is really seen as the founder, or at least the leader of the modern Zionist movement, calls and organizes the International Jewish Congresses toward the establishment of a Jewish homeland in the ancient land in Palestine, the land of the Jews. From 1890 onward, then, we have this development. The idea of a nation state for the Jews does not begin after World War II. We have to begin with people publicly thinking and planning and working toward it from 1890, primarily in Europe initially, but then later on with the development of what's called the Yeshuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, actively working for it. And then with the Russian immigrants who came after the pogroms of 1903 and 1905, coming to establish a new kind of Jewish structure in Palestine, which was not so much a religious Jewish structure, but a secular nation-building group of people who were not bound to the old ways, but simply were saying, we have to do something new. And they are, so we have this development of the modern Zionist movement from 1890 toward its full culmination in 1948 with the declaration of the modern state of Israel. In 1917, pick that date simply because as a date in World War I, when General Allenby enters Jerusalem and ends 400 years of Turkish rule. Part of the war, of course, we all know from reading or hearing about Lawrence of Arabia, we know that much of the war in the Middle East and fought against the Turkish rule was done by Arab forces who, one way or another, were promised some kind of freedom and nationality by the British and the French. So from 1917 onwards, we have people in the Arab world who are seeking political nationalism because of the freedom granted by the ending of Turkish rule. These are also people who, for the last two generations, have received some of the best of Western education, beginning with the establishment of the American University in Beirut and St. Joseph's University, other Western universities in Cairo, begin to have the beginning of Western thought entering in to the Middle East. And many of them took the notions of liberalism, of democracy, of freedom, of revolution to heart. So when they had the opportunity, they saw the fight against the Turks not as allying themselves with British, but as a tide of revolution to establish a new Arab nation. The original goal was the idea of a pan-Arab nation that would stretch from the Euphrates to the Nile and from the Gulf to the Balkans. You know, one nation that would be the Arab nation. Now, these two movements developed independently. They had separate goals. And they really did not have much contact with each other until after 1929. And then it was, particularly in Mandatory Palestine, that the mutual claims of Arab nationalism and political Zionism began to clash over the issue of Palestine. Because by 1929 and then by the mid-30s, Iraq had been established, what was then called the Kingdom of Transjordan had been established, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was established, Egypt was still a monarchy and was slowly creaking its way toward the 1952 revolution. And so one of the few areas left of colonial rule in the Middle East, although British rule was still very much evident, direct rule was still in Palestine and French rule in Syria and Lebanon. France gradually pulled out of Syria, established Lebanon in the early 30s, and then pretty well pulled out, the British being about the last ones to leave, and then in the particular area of Mandatory Palestine, with its problems of the clash between these two separate but increasingly conflicting goals. So the British tried to deal with this throughout the 1930s, especially with the White Papers, things called the King-Crane Commission from the United States, working towards some kind of conclusion until World War II broke out. From 1939 to 1945, the Western powers simply did not have the ability to deal with Middle East issues. The major rule at that time was simply don't cause trouble. To Iran, to Iraq, to Mandatory Palestine, to Egypt. As the European Civil War was fought out across Northern Africa and throughout the Middle East, basically the people of the Middle East remained non-combatants. I mean, it was the French and the Australians and the Americans and the British fighting the Germans and the Italians across the territory of Egypt, Libya, Morocco, and all the rest. If the troops there entered the fighting, it was simply that they got caught up in the war. Basically, they were not full parties to the conflict, and they were just as glad when it was done. Post-World War II period, we had two things to deal with. One was the exhaustion of the West. 6 years for Europe, 4 years for the United States, millions of lives, billions of dollars, and a lot of delayed hopes. And came the end of the war in 1945, there just was not a lot of interest in trying to solve other little problems. Everybody wanted to go home. Most of all the British. There was not the moral will to simply deal with all the post-World War II colonial problems. And see, so we begin to see the decline of the British Empire around the world, the decline of the Dutch Empire, the French, everybody begins to pull back. Finally, the British simply say they're tired and they leave. The other thing that has happened with the Holocaust and World War II meant that we have tremendous numbers of Jewish refugees who are moving into Palestine and continuing this one conflict at that point. But at the same time, the rest of the Middle East is also undergoing conflict. Do you remember, anybody from that period, remember there was a lot of conflict, American-Russian along the lines of Eastern Europe. Anybody remember the major American-Russian confrontation in the Middle East?
They moved out of Iran.
Right, exactly. Russians simply moved down and took northern Iran. And the United States says, you have to leave, or the United States thought they just demobilized everybody. There was nobody left, really, to fight a war. Finally worked out the Russians did move out, but there in 1945, 46, we see the beginnings of Russian-American confrontation in the post-war period, not just in Eastern Europe, which is always overshadowed, but in the Middle East as well. So, post-World War II period, the British pull out, give it up, Israel declares themselves independent. By the way, does anybody remember who sponsored the original partition resolution in the United Nations, which in effect legitimizes the modern state of Israel as a nation? Anybody remember who sponsored that resolution?
Wasn't it Britain?
Nope. Both. It was co-sponsored. United States and the Soviet Union. One of the very few times that there has been a co-sponsored resolution. It's in 1947, was over this one issue because no one could really be caught against it. Both had kind of promised it. So it was, but after that, the 1948 war, Israel succeeds in establishing itself, and basically we end with a problem that no one quite knows what to do with. At the same time, Western interests are primarily drawn to Eastern Europe, partly to do nation rebuilding, and partly the Stalinist era as it moves into Eastern Europe. And of course, then our eyes suddenly turn eastward, because 1948, what kinds of things are happening farther east? Korea begins. What else?
China.
Mao Zedong overcomes the nationalist hordes. They move off to Taiwan. And so in these two distant parts of the world, Europe and the and in Asia, there are simply greater problems, and these little wars are being fought out, and no one really is paying much attention to them. Until 1956, when after the coup that has overthrown King Farouk and President Nasser has come to power, the British and the French and the Israelis gather together to plan an attempt, one, to overthrow President Nasser, two, to regain control of the Suez Canal, which Nasser had seized from the British. The British, you remember, having in effect taken it because Egypt in the 19th century could not repay all the loans that the rulers had extended over their cotton. And so Nasser had nationalized it. The British and the French and the Israelis move in. The one thing they had not counted on was a terribly antagonistic reaction from the United States. Dulles, who I do not consider to be one of the better secretaries of state, was terribly upset that they had not even bothered to tell them, and Eisenhower was furious. Partly why? What else was happening in 1956? Hungary, exactly. So what did the Russians propose to the United States in 1956? Once the British and the French and the Israelis have moved in, what else would they propose? A joint force. Let's join forces to go in and protect the Egyptians against these foreigners. So on the one hand, Eisenhower is caught having to say, no, you better stay out of the Middle East, and telling the British and the French, our supposedly closest allies, that they have in effect 3 days to get out of there, or face the prospect of American troops moving in. And you remember that brought about the fall of the British government at the time, led to the fall of the French government, and the Israelis are finally forced to pull back, leaving Nasser victorious and the great hero of the Arab world. Because finally, not just have the colonial powers withdrawn, but the two major colonial powers, British and France, have been decisively defeated without a war at the hands of one of the Arab nations. And that effectively has eliminated British and French involvement for the next 15 to 20 years. from 1956 on, and brought the United States increasingly in concern with the Middle East, partly because we happened to be there, partly because of the Russian influence. That brought about the Dulles Doctrine, which was that friendly nations throughout the Middle East could always count on the United States for help, which the Middle East took to be a gentle threat. Like, if you take anybody else's help, you're in trouble. Which led to what in 1958? The Marines landed for the first time on the beaches of Lebanon. Probably the first time the Marines had landed on a beach and had to be careful, not because of mines, but because of sunbathers. That's serious. And there literally were people laying out on the beach when the Marines landed who just kind of watched them go by. 1956 was really the end of the colonial period. The next 11 years leading to greater tension, 1967, with the Arab-Israeli War, the 1967 War, the Six-Day War, the June War, then 1973, the October War, or the Yom Kippur War, which is seen by the Arabs as a turning point, as a decisive victory. One, because it led to the recapture of Sinai, ultimately by Egypt. Also because in 1973, the Arabs make use of a new weapon for the first time. What? Oil. And we have the great oil embargo of 9 years ago. How many of you remember 29 cent a gallon gas? Remember it? 1973, you can remember it disappearing. And suddenly becoming very, very aware that we were increasingly and inextricably dependent upon that part of the world for our energy resources. And yet we had no interest there, we had no military there, and we didn't have a whole lot of great friends there. And recognizing that the Russians also had similar interests and similar problems there. Since then, of course, we've had the 1978 Latani operation by the Israelis. We've had the overthrow of the Shah in 1980 and 81, the Iran-Iraq war going on. We had in the 60s Muammar Gaddafi coming to power in Libya with a radical Arab regime. We've had various other nations go through coups. We've had the death of Nasser and the rise of President Sadat. We've had the assassination of President Sadat. We've had numerous changes in the leadership of Lebanon, of Syria, of Iraq. So the period has been one of great confusion, with losses and gains never quite knowing, never quite sure who is where. Egypt itself is an example, as they have gone between American aid and Russian aid. Remember in the 50s, there was very strong American influence in the post-1956 period. Then what happened? Turned around and basically accepted Russian aid. And then President Sadat, fearful of Russian domination, basically ordered them all out of the country and turned to the United States for aid. So there, and this has also played out in Syria. It's happened in Jordan. It's happened in Iraq. With a tenuous hold by any foreign government on any kind of alliance. And the national governments of the Middle East always very cautious of being too friendly with anybody, and wanting very much to maintain some kind of balance. The major changes since 1960, I'd like to talk about three changes and then stop. One, the Arab world has recognized that they are not fully independent. The colonial rule might be over. There might be somewhat of a period of stability in the majority of regimes, and they might be economically and politically established, but they are not independent. Two great witnesses to that. First, of course, Afghanistan. That basically the Russians moved into Afghanistan, which can be included as part of the Middle East, and the Middle East really couldn't do anything about it. There, in fact, is no military force in the Middle East that could withstand a major outside invasion, with the possible exception of Egypt, simply because it has the size of an army, or Israel because it has the third largest army in the world. So Afghanistan is a witness that the Middle East recognized that it simply is no longer independent. Secondly, recognizing they are not independent by the fact that the major powers of the world consider the Middle East to be something of a playground, or at least places that they all have very specific spheres of influence. President Carter made a speech about the Middle East in which he, in effect, said that if we feel that any of our vital interests are ever threatened in the Middle East, the United States would take appropriate action. And the Middle East basically said, your interests. That's kind of like Russia talking about Nebraska as being part of their vital interest because they're dependent upon grain. You know, or someone, the Middle East saw that as a threat. Increasingly, they believed it was a threat by the stationing of part of the international peacekeeping force in the Sinai, which is the buffer zone between Israel and Egypt, which sounds very nice to us. It's American troops who are sitting lazing themselves in the sun and not having a whole lot to do. The Sinai is not your lively spot of the world. The Middle East doesn't see them as just any United States troops, but as a very specific contingent, which happens to be, if I remember correctly, of the two, the 82nd Airborne out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which has the peacekeeping mission as one of its assignments. Another part of its mission is what President Carter set up and President Reagan has extended as the RDF. A deployment force, which was basically set up to counter our lack of available people in the Middle East, basically saying we should have a capability of airlifting substantial troops and equipment within 48 hours from the United States to anywhere in the world. And the Middle East does not see the 82nd Airborne there as coincidental. That in effect they look on them as an advanced base of a potential American military involvement in any place the United States would choose to operate throughout the Middle East. So, the Middle East has recognized that they are not fully independent, that there are other concerns going on a totally different level. It's shown up in the latest war, the Arab-Israeli war, because the arms merchants of the world are basically going around using the current war as a way of saying, well, see what our weapons did to their weapon systems, see what our planes did to their planes, and the Russians countering saying, the problem is they didn't use them properly, so if you buy our weapons, what you really have to do is buy our training techniques as well, and then you won't get caught like the Syrians. And everybody is saying, see what a great training ground the Lebanese conflict was, because we got to try out all these weapons. I mean, the United States has not been able to try out a lot of like tank warfare weapons in the last 15, 20 years. Vietnam was not a great tank testing ground. And so it's in effect partly a playground of the great powers. Secondly, what's happened in the Middle East, part of the conflict, there's a high level of disunity, a tremendously fragmented community. Islam, which was to be the great unifying force of Arab nationalism, has failed. We have the Iran-Iraq war and multiple other conflicts. There is not a political unifying force. There are no great charismatic leaders like a Nasser. There's a serious lack of trust between nations, between Syria and Jordan, between Jordan and Iraq, between Iraq and Iran. Nobody's quite sure what to do with Egypt anymore. Saudi Arabia feels that it's very, very shaky now. Simply because it's very rich and very very weak. Everybody looks at Muammar Gaddafi and is not quite sure what he's going to do next. Nobody's quite sure what's going to happen if the Palestinians will take over Tunisia as they took over Lebanon. The Palestinians are scattered around and basically nobody really likes the Palestinians. The Arab world really doesn't. And not quite sure what to do with them. They're not quite sure what to do with Israel. On the other hand, Israel is not quite sure what to do with the Arab world. The high level of disunity and tremendous lack of trust between all parties to the conflict is a second major factor that's going on in the Middle East. Hence, nobody is ever terribly honest. And seldom will you have anybody revealing their deepest political feelings. The third aspect, beyond the that they're not independent, that they're highly fragmented, the third aspect, there's been a real failure of modernization. One of the dreams of Arab nationalism and one of the thoughts of Jewish Zionism was that the Middle East, the Arab Islamic world, could be lifted up out of an ancient period and brought into the modern period. What's basically happened is that the Arab world did buy the Western world's technology, the scientific method, educational techniques, the whole thing has been bought, and it basically has not worked. The greatest witness to that, of course, is Iran, that for 20 years, with substantial military help, from returning the Shah to his throne after the revolution in the 50s, to the high involvement of the best and the brightest of American business, American industry, American military, American diplomacy, that supposedly was developing this nation as a Western democratic nation, in a matter of a year, the whole thing collapses. And basically the West is rejected. They're caught somewhat in a bind now, though. Because in effect they're having to use all that Western technology in order to defend the nation. The one reason that a turning point was made some 9 months ago, or almost a year ago, in the war with Iraq, is that Iran let all of its pilots that had trained in the United States out of prison and put them back into all those American-supplied planes and attack helicopters with all those American weapons and began attacking the Iraqis. So in effect they're using it, but there's a sense of using the devil's weapon to fight Satan, which is how they view the war with Iraq. But other than that, throughout the Arab world today, there's a real sense of wanting to be neither East nor West, neither capitalist nor socialist, that they're seeking a new direction. And that Western democratic secularism or secular nationalism is not the way they want to go. And that they want to find a new way, or a new way of controlling the technology which they fear is essentially damaging unto their tradition and quality of life. Problems. Israel and the Arabs, of course, have yet to learn to deal with one another. It's not just problems on one side, but problems on both sides. Neither side knows what really to do with each other. All of the people in the Middle East have to adjust to the fact that whether they like it or not, they're part of an international global system. Partly because of the energy concern, partly because both the United States and the Soviet Union, for better or worse, at this point are both thinking in global strategies. And when you think in global strategies, you don't leave out part of the world. And you count every individual nation as important. And they're always defined as our side or their side. Not just, you know, it's not just we Americans who think that. You know, Russians will think that too. And you get the people who in between who don't want to be either one, like people of the Middle East, who say there's got to be a third way. Another problem, the Western slowness to really reject colonial ways. We're not quite sure how to deal with the fact that our energy resources are very much tied up out of our hands. Except that we have begun to take it seriously. The amount of conservation that has happened in the last 3 to 5 years would not have been dreamt possible 10 years ago. That we would basically be as concerned about conservation as we've become. Whether it's for good high moral principles or simply because we're all getting strapped for cash is immaterial at this point. We have learned to conserve. And we have learned to live a little cooler in the summer and a little warmer in the winter and not drive so much and all these little things. And we're, you know, we are learning. A fourth problem, but we're still caught in that bind of what to do, how to deal with these countries who are out of our control, but who are very necessary unto us, like Saudi Arabia, like Iraq, like Iran, like all the rest that have the oil we want. A fourth and final problem is that we've developed, you know, the third most powerful army in the world in the modern state of Israel. And I think you have to grasp what that means. Israel has more tanks and more planes than either Britain or France. Begin to think about it. That they have a fighting ability as an army, as a military machine, to make war with any or all of the Middle Eastern nations at the same time with a high degree of not just winning, but conquering. And the question of being able to take Beirut was never a question. It was political considerations, not military considerations. At the same time, they probably also could, if need be, take Amman, take Jordan, and retake the Sinai and move on to Cairo, though why anybody would want Cairo, I do not know. There's one joke I have to tell you. During the 1973 war, when Eric Sharon crossed the Sinai, the apocryphal story is that he sent a telegram to the Red Cross to the to President Sadat saying, "Am X miles outside of Cairo, am advancing, plan to take Cairo." And that the answer he got back is Ahlan wa sahlan, an Arabic phrase which means you are welcome to everything. but it's a problem. What do you do with a military machine when you've got it and it's ready to go? It's not easy to stop fighting when you've developed that kind of army, and it's not easy once an army gets moving to stop it. And what to do with it as a force in the Middle East. Because, in effect, we have to recognize that the majority of people in the Middle East do not believe that the Arabs can conquer Israel. And you hear this rhetoric sometimes of the Arabs calling for the Israel to be driven into the sea. Nobody in his right mind seriously believes that that could be done. In fact, the majority of Arab nations live in a steady fear that Israel will decide to attack because no one could really withstand their advance. And they could go all the way into Iraq, they could take any nation they want, and no one is really there able to stop them. There is no balance of power in the Middle East. And we need to take that seriously, that we are not in the situation more of a little nation against, you know, mighty hordes. We've basically taken a nation the size of New Jersey, but even the size of Connecticut, with the population, less than half the population of Chicago, a third of the population of metropolitan Los Angeles, and made them into the third most powerful military machine in the world. 3.2 million people are Jews in Israel. There are another 600,000 Arabs, but those 3.2 million people comprise the army. It's amazing when you begin to think of it, the effectiveness of the nation in building an army. But the problem is that in terms of balancing, the nations in the Middle East, therefore, are afraid of Israel. And it's difficult to make peace when you are basically afraid. I've talked too long, it's 7:45. I am going to stop there and not say anything more because it's time for questions or comments or reflections. If I've confused you, it's partly because I plan to do so. I find it terribly confusing and I don't see why I should be confused and you shouldn't be confused along with me. I also find it very exciting. Sometimes if I often get a question is what's good to do, what side to be on? The only things I ever advise people to do are, one, don't take sides. There are enough people in the Middle East who have already taken sides. 220 million people scattered around the Middle East, all of whom have a very definite political viewpoint. They don't need any more. What we do need are people who are committed to a statement that I've learned up here at Holden, which I was going to put in. While I put that up, the second thing I ever recommend to people is simply read the paper. Up here, I've simply read the little Wenatchee paper, a good small town newspaper. It's amazing the amount of information you can get from a little paper if you read it regularly. And that is what we simply need. We need more people who are willing just on a daily basis to sit down and read. And begin to think a bit like, what does it mean that 800 United States Marines landed in Lebanon on 2 days ago? And some more arrived yesterday and some more today. So we have U.S. Army in the Sinai, and we have the Marines in Lebanon. And the Navy standing off the coast with the sixth fleet.
We've forgotten our history. It's only 15
years old. Yeah. That's the statement I'm carrying back from Holden to the Middle East, that there simply is no way to peace. Peace is the way, which makes absolutely no sense in the Middle East. Therefore, it must have some truth. Yeah?
Question. Are the Palestinians or the Arabs in Israel, the West Bank, are they being persecuted? Are there legitimate rights that they have that you feel are not being respected? Human rights that Israelis are not respected?
Two separate groups there. First of all, remember that Israel has 600,000 citizens who are Arab. They're full citizens, they vote, they pay their taxes. And like all Israeli citizens, they all cheat on their taxes. It's an amazing system. The only thing that they're not allowed to do is that they're not allowed to serve in the army. Whether that is discrimination or charity depends upon your political point of view. The Israelis say that it is charitable because they say we ought not to put our Arab citizens in the situation of fighting against other Arabs. The Arabs would basically say, well, they would somewhat agree with that, but they also know that a discharge from the army is the key to a great number of industries. Any security-related industry, for example, the aircraft industry. No one may work in that industry without a honorable discharge from the Israel Defense Forces. And no Arab would ever get one, therefore no Arab will ever work, for example, as an aeronautical engineer. So there are certain professions that are closed. Israel would say that if that is discriminatory, it's because we live in a wartime situation and then Prime Minister Begin, with his way of speaking, would say the United States, with its wartime treatment of minorities, ought not to complain about the way we treat minorities in our wartime. On the West Bank, Israel does not admit the legitimacy of the 1949 Geneva Convention of on occupied territories as being applicable there. I believe that there is, well, first of all, I believe that there is simply no good military government. You cannot be a benevolent military government, and you cannot benevolently occupy another country. You're only doing it because you're at war. Therefore, essentially, you're beginning from a negative point of view, and however hard you try to be good, you're still looked on as the conqueror and the outsider.
Yeah,
very much the same thing. You simply cannot be a good occupier. Yeah.
Any way of knowing what portion of the support of this military machine they have over there comes from outside, both in terms of financial support and young people from this country who go over and join the military, or any other country?
Okay, I have no, you know, any Jew who wants to go to Israel, I would agree that that is simply part of their right and their own decision. If they go there, they very likely will serve in the army and might get killed for it. So I don't have a problem with that. What I am concerned about is that next year it'll be over about $1.5 billion in military aid that we funnel into Israel. And well over 70% of all military aid, either is gifts, grants, loans, credits, whatever, that goes in the next fiscal year budget will go to Israel and Egypt. The question is, why are we funneling so much military aid to the two nations as a gift for their having made peace with one another? I'm not quite sure of that myself. But basically, we've been putting well over $1 billion a year into Israel, one way or another, for military aid for the last at least 5 to 6 years. And since 1973, Israel has accounted for at close to half, or the last few years, more than half of the total military aid budget of the United States. And they have the most sophisticated weapons that we produce. Yeah.
I was interested that you didn't mention the Balfour Declaration as something sort of pivotal. Is it my understanding that Mr. Crane from the commission that you mentioned was an observer to that?
Partly, yeah.
And wrote back a report that got filed someplace and forgotten that we ought not to just dislocate the Palestinians?
Yeah. So the Balfour Declaration was a declaration which has a lot of moral weight, but it was not substantive because, in effect, it was Britain saying something about territory that they did not own or control. So in terms of an international law, it was kind of like the United States viewing with a favor the establishment of a homeland for Armenians in Turkey. So it's, and the second part of it was the condition that nobody ought to be disturbed by it. I think it was, why they did it, I'm not quite sure. And I think it took on increased weight in future years. Lord Balfour himself made a tour late in his life throughout the Middle East and had always felt that somehow his contribution was a contribution that would eventually lead to peace in the Middle East. He may someday be proved right. But there's one story of him in Damascus of coming there and just a tremendous demonstration of Arabs against, because of the implications of Balfour Declaration. And it being interpreted to him as, you know, cheers for this great statesman. But for a man who was over 80 years old by that time, I consider it to have been an act of charity. You know, just to let him continue to believe that maybe it was for peace. Yeah?
Did you intentionally leave out the dispersal of the Palestinians and their influence on the countries of Jordan, Syria, Lebanon?
Not intentionally. I think it's there, but I think we have to admit that it's been marginal in that they have yet to establish a long-lasting influence. They went to Jordan in 1967, were kicked out in 70, went to Lebanon in 70, have now been eliminated from Lebanon in 82. Now it's, what they are is a continuing boiling of the pot for the Middle East. And it's The vast majority of Arabs witnessed the first 2 weeks of the war, when there were very few Arab voices raised in other than token statements.
What was Gaddafi's advice to him?
Oh, yeah, Gaddafi is. Nobody in the Arab world listens to Gaddafi either. Funny, you know, then the king of Saudi Arabia died, and suddenly all the Arab leaders had something else to talk about, and they all went out off and, you know, much more interested in that funeral than in what was going on in Lebanon. They're just not terribly interested in the Palestinians.
What are they seeking?
The Palestinians are simply seeking a place to be.
Pretty simple. I mean, some are seeking the state of Palestine back again,
sure.
Are they not?
Mm-hmm.
Not just
so are some
place.
Israelis. Oh yeah, they want a place which has to be, I think, somewhere in mandatory Palestine, in which both groups have to learn that they are simply going to share with another people and another nation, and that they're going to have to learn to live in peace.
Is it worth all this bloodshed?
No.
Seek some place to be?
It is neither worth it, but then they would say there's no other way to get it. One last question, then we have to get off to vespers. Yeah, Tom.
It appears to be a problem that we in the United States and our statesmanship don't understand very much about Islam. And two, that Islamic fundamentalism is bringing down regimes within their own countries, vis-a-vis Iran, the Iran-Iraq war, and other problems. So they can't live together. It's the Sunnis and the Shias that are each other's throats, and so there's no unity within those states. Is that one of the problems? Do you view that?
This is one of the problems, and that's where, you know, at the same time, some of the countries like Saudi are looking at the Palestinians with their secular nationalism as a threat. They're looking at the rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism as another threat. You know, it shows up in Egypt with some radical groups that want to establish an Islamic state. So, anyway, thank you all.